You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hey guys, do you like heavy metal? Do you like video games, comic books, movies, theme parks, or even cool TV shows? We've got the place for you. Metal Geeks. Time to rock out with your geek out. Here are your hosts, Carrie the Metal Geek, Dave, and George. Geek it out, fellas.
Hey, everyone. We are live. We're doing a live. This is episode number 193 of the Metal Geeks podcast. I am one of your hosts. I am Carrie the Metal Geek, along with...
Hi, Brutal Dave. I am here once again, as usual.
I'm appreciative of that, man. And we have a very, very special guest tonight. We're going to geek out with Matt Harvey from multiple bands, Exhumed, Gruesome, and Pounder. Welcome back to the show, my friend.
Right on. Thank you guys for having me. And I may look distracted for just a minute. I'm just going to like post on Facebook real quick that we're live and if people want to talk to me and so forth, then yeah. Okay.
Yeah, if you are out there and you're watching, and we are going to take some questions later for Matt, so get your most geeky questions ready. So we're finally in 2021, man. 2020 was just a shit show for everybody.
Yes, it was.
So walk me through being in a band. You did a lot of cool stuff in 2020, even though we were all stuck at home. You did the live stream. You did a lot of stuff on your YouTube page for Exhumed. Let's talk about some of that stuff. How did those come about? And I'm really interested in the live stream because I watched a lot of live stream concerts this year.
Right.
More than ever before, you know?
Well, you know, we were just talking early on, you know, we had tons of plans that were canceled, like most bands. You know, I really had everything planned out for 2020 up until about September, as far as tours and various different things. And of course, when that all vanished, everybody in Exhumed, we got on a Zoom call, Exhumed. And
they owe you money now.
Right. And so we just kind of talked about different things that we could do, just to sort of let people know that we're still out there. And, you know, of course, in the early days of the pandemic, I think everybody was kind of ravenous for content because all of a sudden you're like, well, I'm used to working 40 hours a week. Now I'm stuck at home.
Yeah.
Like, what am I going to watch? What am I going to see? Blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, we just sort of embarked on building up our YouTube channel, which was something we never really focused on before. We had a concert movie that we debuted in December. And so that was sort of the channel launch. And then we started doing playthroughs and, you know, we did a segment where people wrote us questions and we answer them and stuff. And then, you know, we had talked about the viability of either doing a live stream or filming a show, but because we're all spread out, Ross and I are in California, although he's like 3.5 hours north of me. Our drummer Mike just moved to Ohio before all this happened, and our guitar player Sebastian lives in Baltimore. And so anyway, it just kind of came to a point where a buddy of mine needed a liver transplant and they wanted to do a benefit thing. And at that time, Mike was in California for his dad's 75th birthday. This is like in the fall when case numbers were down and restrictions were looser. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, if we're going to do something, we have to do it like right now. So we just ended up filming a whole show. We recorded in Pro Tools and all that stuff. And then by the time we put it together, you know, we did it for the day after Christmas. And it's a thing where you can stream it and or download it. And, you know, we kept it cheap. I think it was like $8. Now it's $10. But, you know, mainly it's just kind of because a big part of touring beyond obviously playing and earning the money you make from playing is just sort of keeping the band alive in the minds of the audience, you know. And we wanted, you know, we're a very active band. And so we wanted to try and maintain that relationship with the kids and to, you know, just let people know that we're still out here. We're a going concern. And, you know, there's still stuff that if you're a fan or if you want to be involved or whatever, there's stuff to take part in beyond just sitting around and waiting for the next record kind of thing, you know?
I appreciate a lot of the bands and what you guys did. I watched it, was great. What a lot of the bands are doing to, you know, survive this past year. Do you think this is going to change the way people are going to bring in their ingesting music now? Do you think, okay, I'd rather just wait for a live stream or something?
I mean, I hope not, because, you know, even when we were filming the show, it was weird because we're on a stage with lights and shit.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you obviously be playing the song, going through, and then you get done and you're like,
there's not that immediate reaction that you're looking for. Yeah. Right. Right.
I watch so many of the bands doing their like live stream concerts and stuff like that, having that moment. Like, you can see them have that moment of realization where they're done and they're like, oh yeah, there's nobody
here. Do you guys want to hear another? Well, I don't know if you guys want to hear another one, but I guess we're doing one. So I mean, I think that, you know, in the heat of the moment, the especially, you know, for the underground shows where you're 15, 5, 35 feet away from the band, you're like really kind of doing something together. And that you can't really replicate. I mean, sure, it's nice to be sitting there in your pajamas, you know, and you can pause between songs to take a piss or get a beer or whatever. But I don't think you can really replace that moment.
Yeah.
And, you know, so hopefully it might be a thing that people will try to do more of, but I'm curious how much interest there will be once shows resume, you know.
It's hard to replicate that live experience of, yeah, you know, interacting. I mean, you're right up there in front of like the band, man. They're looking in your eyes and they can see you're into it, and it pumps them up even more. It's just it's hard, man.
It's like an energy feedback loop or whatever. Like the band is delivering the music, which energizes the crowd, and then they're giving that energy back to the band, which in turn makes them play with more intensity or perform, and so on and so forth. And, you know, if everyone's having a good time, then it can really become something really special. And, you know, I think it also, like when we filmed our show, for me, that was like a 16-hour day. I remember I was, you know, up at 7 in the morning, you know, like just getting everything ready and buying like catering and shit for the show. And then we loaded in at 10 a.m. and then we started filming at 1. And then by the time we were done filming, I think we were loading out at like 9, so I didn't end up leaving until like 11. And so we filmed for hours, you know. Yeah. I mean, we took a break for lunch. But when you don't have that audience reaction, it's hard to get that second, third win. Right. You know, because you're not normally, you have this sort of built-in, like I said, the energy source. So it's, I think it's a great option for now, and I think it's cool, but I don't know, man. It's not something that, as a fan, it's not like ideal for me, you know.
Did you watch any other live streams?
I watched a little bit of the Asphyx one the other day. And then my wife and I went to the drive-in to see the Metallica thing that they filmed, their show movie thing. and that was fun because we were at the drive-in, you know. I'm trying to think. I know there's like one other one that I've seen. And I've just seen some of like the Slay at Home things and stuff, yep, that some of my friends have done. But even then, and I guess I shouldn't be saying this because I should want people to buy our gig, but I enjoy just watching some old bootleg of a guy with a camcorder at an actual show with people. Like, that gets me more excited as a fan. So.
Yeah, I used to do tape trading back in the day and just bootleg after bootleg. Like,
right.
It was a lot of fun. You know?
Yeah, I mean, YouTube came along and it's much more convenient now, because so much of the stuff is just on YouTube. But yeah, I had stacks. And there's still a few of them just around in the studio control room where I am now. Just various VHS tapes we used to watch over and over and over.
Yeah, I had hundreds of them. And I when I moved out of my parents' house way back in the day, I had to make the decision just to leave them, just get rid of them. It was like, it's right, too much trouble, you know? So let's get into a little bit of history. You've been doing this band for more than 30 years now.
I think it's technically we put our first show in October of 91. It was right after I turned 16. I was like, I've been 16 for like 5 days or something like that. So coming up on 30 years. Yeah.
Wow.
Really long time.
Cool. Very
Did you imagine it lasting this long when you first started that band?
No. I mean, I don't think.
Did you have a concept that like you were going to be around? did this point in life exist in your head when you're 16 years old? Because I can tell you, for me, when I was 16, this didn't exist. Like,
yeah, I mean, I guess, on one hand, I didn't really like have like a backup plan, being like, well, I'm going to go to college and become a gynecologist after I'm done being in a rock band or whatever. I never had anything like that, but at the same time, I didn't really think that death metal would be something people would be interested in 30 years, you know? So the fact that, you know, there's still a scene and a demand for it is kind of shocking, you know? Especially because, you know, being young and being into first like regular heavy metal and then thrash and then death metal or whatever, it kind of, especially in the pre-internet age, things kind of, once they were gone, they were just sort of gone. You know, it wasn't like you would go to a record store in 1993 and you would see like, oh, look, here's a copy of, you know, Violent Restitution by Razor or Bonded by Blood or whatever. It was like, no, nobody carried that shit anymore because that shit was over. And so I just imagined that eventually death metal, I don't really know what I thought would happen, but I didn't think that you'd still be able to go see Morbid Angel and Cannibal Corpse and Carcass and Napalm Death and, well, not in 2020, but in 2019. I didn't really see that as being a,
I know, possible. I think we're probably about the same age because I'm 46 now, so
okay, I'll be 46 in October, so
it's my birthday in October, so a little bit older. But yeah, I mean, all that growing up in that time period, man, it was amazing. All the people think, you know, when was the best time to grow up? I'm like, man, we had all of the good stuff growing up and got to see them live. And when they're in their heyday, man, it's just,
it's one of those things, especially because now, you know, the nostalgia cycle that runs through not just metal, but all pop culture.
Yep.
But because the nostalgia cycle is on when I was in high school, whereas, you know, 5 or 6 years ago when it was still like the thrash thing, I was a thrash kid, but I wasn't like, aside from buying the records and like headbanging in my room and videotaping Headbangers Ball, I wasn't really like an active scene participant because I was 12. Mm. And, you know, I'd tell my parents like, I want to go see Death Angel. And they'd be like, you're 12. You know, I don't know what Death Angel is, but no.
Yeah.
Just no. I'm not driving you there, you know, no. And so it wasn't really until like 89 that I started going to gigs. And then very quickly from there, by 90, you know, I was already like, oh, Slayer's weak, dude. I'm into Terrorizer. Like, I was like, great. By the time I was 15, I was just like, death metal is it. You know?
What was your first show that you ever went to?
My first show was Anthrax, Exodus, and Halloween in April of 89.
Yeah, I missed that.
Yeah, it was the MTV Headbangers Ball tour.
Yeah.
I think because it was on TV and one of my friend's parents were driving us, my parents were like, well, I guess it's on TV. Like, it can't be so bad, you know?
And my very first show was Anthrax opening for Iron Maiden in 90.
Oh, sick.
Yeah, awesome. Which is now, unfortunately, Lakewood Church, but it used to be Metal Mecca. All the big shows would come there to the Summit in Houston. Right. Yeah. Where Testament filmed a music video back in the day.
Okay. Which video?
I was going to ask that too. What video?
It's the Aerosmith cover, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Nobody's Fault.
Yeah. There, you see the old Summit sign. I'm like, man, hate driving by there now.
Oh, that's sad.
What was your first big show?
That show was pretty big. I mean, I think it was like a 5,000 capacity. Like, it wasn't an arena. It was like a convention center or something like that. But then that summer, I saw Metallica and Faith No More at a place called Shoreline Amphitheater in Mountain View. There's actually the whole show is on YouTube and it's great. It's so good. And then I think at the end of that year, the third show I saw was Testament, Nuclear Assault, Testament of Voivod, Nuclear Assault at the Warfield, which is probably familiar to most people because I know Slayer's had a video there and stuff.
Yeah. What was the first underground stuff you started going to?
That was in 90, and I think, I know I saw, it might have actually been 89, I saw Defiance because I won tickets on the radio. My parents were like, well, we won tickets, I guess we have to drive them to San Francisco. I saw Defiance, like, and then I saw in March, that was December 90. And then 1990, I started going to a lot of shows because my friends started going there. I was like the youngest kid in my group of friends. And so I had friends who were like 15, 16, and we could all go to shows. So I saw like Death and Devastation in March of 90. I saw Death again with Carcass and Pestilence in October of 90. And I'm trying to think, because Napalm didn't play till 91. I saw the Sepultura Obituary Sadist tour.
Wow. Oh, yeah.
In 90.
You have a much better memory than me, man. I can't even remember what band I saw like last year together. I'm like, did this band play with that band? I can't remember.
I have no idea what happened last year, but this is all stuff. I have like a very smooth brain. It was like ready to be imprinted with all this stuff back then.
I was like, I've seen these bands before. I don't remember if I saw them together or what year it was or when. Okay. There's a certain one that stick out in your mind, you know?
Right. Yeah. And then I think I turned 15 in October of 90, and then the next spring I got a job. So by then I had plenty of friends with cars, yep, and I had my own money, and I was just like, cool, I'm going to go.
Yeah, I got my learner's permit at 15, so I started going, doing whatever I wanted, right, early. I saw Dead Horse so many times.
That was like a local band for you,
local,
right?
Band, yeah, for sure. Yeah. They played all the time. And then I saw Pantera before Cowboys came out.
Nice.
And, yeah.
Dave, do you have an anecdote to share? Where I feel like
I'm flashing back. My experience was maybe a little bit different. For me, all I grew up in a evangelical household, and so like all of the stuff was very verboten. I was still into music as a teenager, but it was very limited on what I had access to.
Wow.
But I, my first, if you want to call it underground experiences, was actually the local scene in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. I would go to just see the local like hardcore and metal bands, hard rock bands, grunge bands, a lot of that stuff. I'm also a little bit younger than you guys, so it was just kind of what was there. But at that time, I was also starting to get into some of the more like mainstream accessible metal, you know, Metallica and Megadeth and those kinds of things. That whole like 90s alt rock grunge thing, like that's where I came up in. And so I still have a lot of love for a lot of those bands. But then I also was getting into, I was learning how to play guitar. And so I had like a real thing for intricate guitar work. And so I was getting into more proggy stuff, Dream Theater. And I listened to, you know, Joe Satriani and a lot of these like guitar wankery stuff. And it was, and then, so there was that kind of stuff that I was listening to, but then I was going to local shows that were largely just like kids from the area playing hardcore, just like screaming and making noise a lot of times. And I loved the energy of that. I loved the intensity and the volume. And so it was later that I found that I really found like extreme metal that was blending those things that I like, that had the music,
guitar work, and that energy.
The,
sure.
Not in the guitars and everything. Then all of the music was way more intricate,
right?
But then it had that intensity too. Yeah. And I was probably 18 by the time I was actually starting to get into that stuff, and well into college when I was really getting into like the metal scene.
Wow.
So first show for me, I'm like, God, I don't even know. I don't know. I couldn't tell you. I've seen some bad ones though. That's for sure.
I'm sure we all have.
We all have, yeah.
One of those early shows had to have been, I saw Van Halen with Gary Cherone.
Wow.
One of my very first shows was, me and my buddy were like my best friend back in the day, who's no longer with us now, but we were huge Skid Row fans back in the day, like 88, 89. My parents took us to see Skid Row open up for Bon Jovi. We could not, Bon Jovi played a couple songs and we're like, yeah, we're out of here. We can't handle this. We left. Went to like the local, there was like a Hilton next door to the play, to the Summit, and like some old dude offered us beer. We're like, yeah, we should probably leave. Let's get out of here. All right. Good so times. Going back to, let's go back to your projects a little bit. Sure. They're all three different sounding as hell. Pounder is definitely part of that new retro wave of, I hate to call it, label anything, but I listened to the brand new album. It was streaming on, well, I can't remember which website it was now.
It was on Decibel.
Yeah, Decibel. Comes out Friday. Let's talk about that, because it was really, really good.
It was cool. I listened to the Decibel stream yesterday, too. I enjoyed it.
Awesome.
It was cool.
Thanks, guys. That was something that, you know, we were planning on doing last year anyway. It's just with the pandemic, our timetable moved up a little bit. And it was originally slated to come out like right after Thanksgiving. But again, because of the pandemic, there's delays at all the vinyl pressing plants. So to be on the safe side, it was like, you know, it was possible to get it out last year, but it was kind of risky. So we just pushed it back to January, because I think we recorded it in something like April. It's been quite a while now. So to me, it's like really, the album's like really old.
Right.
But yeah, and I guess, you know, it is part of the new wave of traditional heavy metal, or whatever you want to call it. It's something that I had been wanting to do for a long time, you know, like even like 12, God, you know, like two, I guess like 15 years ago now.
Yeah.
Because before Exhumed split up, we were talking about Pounder. Like we used to, like, it was like our joke fake band, you know, like, oh, Pounder, what's the album going to be called? Oh, it's going to be called Breaking the World. Like, yeah, it's like, because, you know, I was listening to a lot of, like, you know, Diamond Head and Angel Witch and Tank and that stuff. And you'd be on tour and you'd be in the middle of nowhere at 3 a.m. and you got to take a piss in the gas station. And you got to be like, hey, man, y'all in a band? And we just used to say stupid names. Like, yeah, dude, we're called fucking Sex Mustache or whatever. And somehow Pounder grew out of that. And so that was just the one I settled on. Like, oh, yeah, my band's called Pounder. And, you know, there was like, oh, I never heard you guys, but I think I heard y'all. You know, like,
what do you sure you say? Have.
And so, anyway, it just kind of stayed like an idea for a while. And then, you know, I wrote a couple, you know, several years later, fast forward 7 years later or whatever. I wrote a couple of songs and didn't really think much of it. And then I started seeing Night Demon started playing around. And I was like, hey, these guys are, this is like what I was wanting to do. This is awesome. And my buddy Alejandro, who also does like sound for Exhumed, and you know, like he produced the last record and stuff. Anyway, so he and I were like, all right, let's do this. And the idea was always that we were going to find a singer, but we never found a singer. But we did find a really good lead guitar player. And so I was like, well, I guess I'm going to just have to try and sing and we'll see what happens. And here we are. Now we've got two records out. So, yeah.
Sounds great, man. So you said you did this back in April. How was it doing an album during the pandemic?
I mean, we've always done everything remotely with Pounder. So It really wasn't any different. It's really nice having somebody in your band that's an audio engineer. like, it just really opens up a lot of possibilities. And now that we built the studio I'm sitting in, this is a control room, before we recorded the last Exhumed record in 2019. So I've got a studio here as well. So it's just, it wasn't very difficult at all, really. It was the same way that we've always worked, basically. We hired Gus from Gruesome, tracked some of the songs, and then when we expanded it from an EP to an album, we had our buddy Adam in the Bay Area. He tracked drums for a couple other songs, and then we just, you know, started sending each other the parts, and pretty soon it was like, oh, cool, we got an album. And really, you know, it's really easy for me because Tom records all the guitars. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like I write a lot of the songs, but basically once the song's written, I give it to Tom, and then we kind of work through it that way. So I just kind of sat back and was like, cool, I'm ready to, you know, record some vocals whenever. And then, yeah, it was done.
Is this something you could take on the road when that does happen again?
Yeah, I mean, we've played a few shows. We haven't done anything like long haul touring, but I think we did about 2 weeks. I was going to say last year, but it was 2019 now. So we did about 2 weeks in 2019, and you know, we played like the Decibel Metal and Beer Fest, mm-hmm. and a few one-off gigs and stuff. It's definitely something that we would like to do live a lot more. It's just between everyone's schedules and now Tom's and Carcass, it's like, it's going to be a challenge no matter what to get something together. But, you know, we are an actual band and we play gigs, and, you know, we want to do as much of that as we possibly can, you know?
Yeah. I can imagine, since, you know, being in three current bands, getting that schedule together, like, hey, here's when Exhumed is going to go out on tour and we're going to have a new album cycle. And here's when we're going to do the new Pounder. Here's when we're going to do Gruesome. How does all that stuff work out? Do you have like this intricate, like calendar set up?
Well, normally, yeah. It's going to be rough, I guess, you know, towards the end of the year, whenever we start transitioning back into that. Especially because within, you know, like in Gruesome, Dan is also in Possessed. Robin, our bass player, is like a tour manager and merch person. She works for everybody from Exodus, Testament, Overkill, Death Angel. Like,
I met her so 2 years ago, I believe.
We saw her, she was, we saw her at the merch table for At the Gates, yep. Dude.
Right. Oh, yeah. She got that tour at the last minute. Yeah. So her schedule is crazy. Dan has Possessed. I've got the other stuff. And then in Exhumed, Sebastian, our guitar player, plays in Noisem. Ross works with another band that I'm not supposed to say that he's in, even though everyone knows he's in it. and so that's, so every band has challenges, you know. It's not just like, oh, I'm in three bands. It's like, I'm in bands of people that are also in other bands. So there's a lot of moving parts. You know, thank God, dude, that it's the 21st century and we have the internet and smartphones and stuff, because I can't imagine doing this like in the 80s, like calling people up like, hey man, like leaving messages on answering machines, like, can you call me back? Because they're going to figure this out.
Page me back, man. Page me.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
we grew up there, man. I remember when I first got my first computer that you could have like a, I don't know, 1600 or 800 baud dial up. I'm like, this is amazing. This is the internet. What is going on? I can actually chat with people about a video game or something. I was blew my mind.
In real time.
Right.
We're always in touch. We have, you know, endless text threads and WhatsApp groups and all that shit. So,
let's talk about Gruesome, because I fucking love Gruesome, dude. Not trying to blow any smoke or anything, but I'm a big Deaths fan, and it's one of the best. You know, I don't want to say it's a tribute to their style, but you don't directly copy the or any of their songs or anything like that.
I mean, it is definitely a tribute band, and we really go out of our way to make that abundantly clear, you know, from the artwork, from the logo, and every gig we've ever played, you know, we'll play like two or three songs. I'll be like, hey, in case anyone's never seen this before, you don't know who we are, like, we are a Death tribute. That's what we're doing here. Like, we're here because we like to, you know, we have fun playing the style and keeping it alive, and everything we're doing, you know, we're trying to do it in a way that's respectful to Chuck's memory and stuff. And that was something that in the very beginning of the project we talked about with Eric Greif, who was Chuck's manager for years and sort mm-hmm. of manages a lot of his intellectual property. You know, that's why we had James Murphy on the first album, like Terry Butler's come and he's come on stage and played some songs with us and stuff. And we've tried to just, you know, on one hand, it's fun as fans, like, I'm like, fuck yeah, I'm playing Born Dead with Terry Butler. Like, if I told myself that I'd be doing this when I was 15, I would have just, like, came in the band. So, on one hand, it's very selfish for us to have a good time. But on the other hand, it's also to let people know that we're doing this with the full knowledge and blessing of the former Death personnel. You know, we recorded a track with Sean Reiner before he passed and stuff. So, like I said, it's twofold. It's one, it's like, you know, it's the ultimate tribute band thing to have a guy from the band play with you. And it's also just to make it abundantly clear that we're doing it in a way that is as respectful as we possibly can do it, you know?
I think it's worth noting as well that, like, as far as like tribute band, that kind of thing goes, it's not just that it's a good tribute band. It's a good band all on its own.
Yeah.
Like the songwriting is great. The performances are great. And, Carrie played Gruesome for me for the first time. You and I were going to a show somewhere and I got in your car and you were like, "Hey, check this out." And it was like, is this some unreleased death material that we're listening to? So, I mean, you know, to the, your credit as, you know, what your goal was there, you know, mission accomplished. But, and then of course, you know, the artwork as well, the artwork, you know, it's all those, I can see specific death album covers and some of them, you know, and so, but it does both things really well. You're like riding that line really well of like, hey, we're totally aping this thing. And this is like, we're being very upfront about what it is we're doing, but we're going to do it really well. And we're going to actually like put some art into it and, you know, take our time. So I really appreciate the band. I think it's great work.
Thanks. I mean, there really is a lot of craft to it. I mean, beyond just like, you know, writing the songs and stuff. Before we did the last record, Jarrett, our producer, he's not even in the fucking band. He called up Scott Burns and talked to him for like 2 hours about spiritual healing. He's like, "So what mics did you use? What amps did you use? What preamps? Right. What kind of effects chains were you running? Blah, 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 blah." And so it really goes, you know, it goes beyond just like, oh, we got Ed Repka to do a cover. Cool. Like, although that was the thing when we signed Relapse, and we're like, whatever the art budget is, like, if we don't have this guy doing it, the whole project will fail. So we have whatever he wants. Like, we have to build
it. I was definitely bringing that up because Ed Repka is a living legend. Right. And man, I just ordered some prints from him. I actually ordered the Rest in Peace print from him, autographed for a holiday present. I'm like, I got to get that. It's like the ultimate piece. But he's such a nice guy too.
He's really super easy to work with. And now that we've done sort of the first three death albums, I'm like sad because we won't use him for the next one. but you know, basically we just give him like, this is the title, here's the concept. And then he sends back the art and we're like, this is perfect. This is fucking, all right, great. It's like, you know, you just, he is so great that, you know, you just sort of get out of his way and let him do his thing. And
yeah.
Yeah, it's awesome.
I'm glad he's making a bigger name for himself now because he's doing all those Super 7 reaction figures and stuff, right? Like that. It's great. Yeah. We have a couple comments real quick. Oscar says, "Greetings from Columbia, Metal Song, Exhumed, and Ms. Sarcastral." I agree on both of those.
I love Columbia. We had such a good time there.
Our good friend of the show, Brian, Gruesome Rules, another Brian. They are the perfect tribute to Chuck.
Thanks, Brian.
Very cool. Yeah.
I figured when we started Gruesome that we were going to get a lot more hate. We got some hate, but I figured that the
really best... hate.
Yeah.
Oh, I saw some of it. I remember seeing some people be like really pissed off about it. It doesn't make any sense to me.
That's the bad part about the internet. People get pissed off for nothing.
I mean, I think on one hand, I get it, and like, it's, you know, if they think it's pointless, it's like, cool, they already have the death records, and that's great. But that was sort of my, you know, I was like, if we don't really make it obvious or this is a tribute, like, we're going to get, like, shit on, like, really fast. So we need to, like, really put it out there, guys. So.
I think that's a good strategic move.
Yeah. Before we move on, let's talk about your other band, Exhumed. You said it's almost 30 years now. Where do you see that that collaboration, that the mixing of horror and metal, how does that come about? What's that relationship like between those two?
I mean, I think they've always been sort of inextricably linked. I mean, the first heavy metal band is Black Sabbath, right? And it's like their name comes from a fucking horror movie.
Yeah,
that's just sort of, I mean, it's like people, And I was into horror movies before I got into metal. I used to love, like, you know, all, this is the 80s, so, and I was very young. So it was like, you know, first was like Nightmare on Elm Street. And then, you know, we found like Toxic Avenger. That was a big one. Then, like, you know, just anything that was gory, like Reanimator was a huge one, Evil Dead 2, From Beyond, Evil Dead 1 for that matter.
And did you ever get around to watching Reanimator?
Yeah, I did.
Have you watched it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good.
They sent me on a long journey because I'm admittedly not the biggest horror fan. I've never seen a lot of stuff. I grew up on like all the slasher stuff. Like I was a huge Nightmare on Elm Street fan as a kid. All the Friday the 13th, Halloween, that type of stuff. But they sent me a list in October of all these movies. I'm like, I've never seen half of these. So I just watched like a movie every day of that month. It was great.
Yeah, awesome. And yeah, I think especially, I didn't really put it together just listening to like, you know, whatever, popular metal and then like thrash. It wasn't as explicit, except for like Slayer, maybe like Rigor Mortis. And but then when I was, Scream Bloody Gore is like one of the first extreme albums I ever heard. And I bought it simply because it had a song title on the tape that said Regurgitated Guts. So I was like, well, yeah, obviously. That's what I was going on. I need to hear what this song is. It's got to be great. And it just sort of was like, oh, this is like the audio equivalent of, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre or whatever. Like, this is the same level of like depravity that I'm getting from these movies. I'm now hearing it in audio form. And, you know, I mean, to me, if you're a death metal band, like, you should be singing about stuff that's morbid, or else they would call it, like, rainbow metal or flower metal or car metal or whatever. So to me, there was never any other option. I was like, well, it's death metal. You sing about death. That's it.
It's in the fucking title.
Right. And so it was just, you know, things dovetailed and we have been singing about gory shit forever, you know? And it's just sort of, it's kind of weird because I love all the horror that I grew up on, but it's not something that I've kept up on a lot. You know, I don't see a lot of new horror movies, which is horrible to talk about in interviews. It's very embarrassing, but it's more, to me, it's just more about the visceral reaction that I had as a kid seeing these movies. And, you know, I mean, we watched horror movies nonstop up until like 96, I think.
Yeah.
You know, that's all. We would get done working our retail jobs, and then we'd go to practice, and then we'd get a pizza and some beer, and there was like, you know, it was still the 90s, so you go to the video store and be like, oh, have you seen violent shit? Oh, fuck, all right, we're renting that. Okay, cool. And that's what we would do after practice because we were all losers that didn't have girlfriends. So, good times.
I think horror movies, I mean, they're still, you know, stuff that we grew up on. They're still out there, but a lot of it is sort of different now in a way too. Do you remember the last good one that you saw?
The last one that I saw that I really, really liked, was The Witch. I've seen a few horror movies since then, and I keep meaning to watch The Lighthouse, but I keep forgetting.
If you liked The Witch, and The Witch is one of my favorite movies, it was my top movie on when we did our list that year.
Yep.
That dude's approach to filmmaking is incredible. I really liked the Lighthouse. It is weird as fuck.
It looks great. I just have been like, I need the right night to watch it. And that night just
right mood for that movie.
My wife and I left the theater, credits rolled, and we looked at each other and went, what the fuck just happened? Awesome. And then we talked about the movie for 2 days afterwards. And we were like, okay, I think we really liked this movie because it generated 2 days worth of conversation out of us about like, what did we think was going on in this movie? I can't wait to see more work from that guy. I think he's a brilliant filmmaker.
I liked Midsommar. I didn't love it, but I liked it.
I liked Midsommar. The other one I watched of, what was the other one? That wasn't everybody.
The one that's usually paired with Midsommar for some reason is Hereditary.
Yeah, Hereditary.
I haven't seen either of them.
Hereditary was okay. But I really got into Midsommar. I don't know why. There was something about that movie.
I liked Hereditary. I thought it was pretty good. It was, and I only watched it once, and it's been a couple of years now. I remember the plot being sort of nonsensical at points. Like, I was like, wait, what? But I really like the overall vibe of it.
Yeah.
The look, pacing, and the, you know, because sometimes, I mean, that's more important in a horror movie than, like, is the plot comprehensible? Is there character development? It's like, does it matter? Is it fucking scary? Is it weird? Is it unsettling? Like, all right, cool. You know,
You don't want to love the characters too much, if they're going to die anyways. I just saw Freaky. Have you guys seen that yet?
No.
It's exactly what it's one of those Blumhouse movies, but it's Vince Vaughn plays a serial killer. It's really brutal in the beginning of it. But somehow they find this old amulet and he switches places. It was like a teenager, like a cheerleader girl. So the rest of the movie, Vince Vaughn is playing the cheerleader as a young girl, and the cheerleader is playing a serial killer. It's really funny, but it's pretty brutal in the beginning too. I definitely recommend it. It's one of Vince Vaughn's best performances. Maybe
it's such an outlandish.
It is.
Like, it sounds like it's worth watching just for that.
Yeah.
I assume it's like a Freaky Friday riff.
Yeah. It's totally Freaky Friday. So you talked about horror movies back when you were a kid. Let's go back a little bit more. What else were you into back then? I know we both share a love of comics.
Right. That was, you know, I was like really dorky. I mean, even though I played like sports and stuff in school, I was always into, you know, like Spider-Man was my really big thing when I was a kid. Star Wars, of course, was the other one. You know, I was born in 75, so that was, you know, it. Yeah. But as soon as I saw that Spider-Man cartoon from the 60s, I was, like, hooked. And that's just stayed with me ever since. And so I got really into comics. I went through, like, a big, like, mythology phase when I was in grade school. I had, like, a big Norse mythology book, a big Greek mythology book. I was a big science fiction reader, like Piers Anthony and what was the guy, Ben Bova, and Robert Heinlein, all those guys. What's the guy? Was it Heinlein that wrote Essence for Space? It's been a long time now. But so I just sort of ran the gamut, you know. I was into like science fiction, horror, comic books. And then tabletop role-playing games. So, like, I was real cool. I wasn't super into video games because my parents never bought me an Atari. They bought, like, an Intellivision instead. And I was like, this is...
Same here, dude. I had the Intellivision. My friend down the street had the Atari. But,
right?
But once the NES came out, I'm like, all right, I was sold. I'm still a video game nerd. That's one of my biggest vices right there to this day, every day.
My wife is the video game player in our household. Yeah,
mine is too. We both have, in our living room, Dave has seen this, we both have TVs set up with Xboxes on them so we can play games while we're in the same room together. It's pretty great.
My favorite thing is, like, when she'll get a game that I'm really interested in, like Star Wars Squadrons, the last Spider-Man game.
Yeah.
And I'll just sit around and just, you know, like, crack open a beer and just watch her play video games. Like, the last Spider-Man game, I was like, she's like, I think I'm going to come off it. I was like, no, come on, babe.
You got to finish it.
We're stable. Like, this is important. And yeah. I'll be like, she'll be trying to, like, defeat Hammerhead. And I'll be like, oh, there was this great storyline where he turned into a ghost. And Dr. Octopus was going to marry Aunt May. And she's like, can you shut the fuck up? I'm trying to play video
games. I remember that. Yeah. That's the Miles Morales game. I just beat that in the Star Wars Squadron game. Man, we played that in VR on the PlayStation.
Oh, wow.
Man, I can usually handle a VR game, but that game just made me sick so quick. I was like, I can't do it. It's like all the spinning around, and I was like, oh, right. Done.
It's like literally being in a plane that's
fucking yes, close. Totally. I was really into X-Men back in junior high. Like, I didn't have a girlfriend either for a while, but X-Men, like, I was a huge New Mutant fan. Still am. All that stuff right there. I still have my whole collection of it. It's great.
Yeah. I started with Spider-Man and like, somewhere around issue, I think 211 was when I started Amazing Spider-Man 211. It was like when I started getting issues here and there sporadically. And then from there, cause you probably remember the Spider-Man as Amazing Friends cartoon.
Oh yeah.
Right. That was like my shit every Saturday morning. I wasn't allowed to like tape stuff on the VCR, but I have my little tape deck and I would just, it has like a condenser mic. So I would fucking tape the episode as I watched it. And then I would like run around the backyard with my toys or like, you know, doing whatever, listening to the episode. And it was such a great show because, you know, you start as a 5 or 6 year old, you only know maybe Spider-Man. And then you're like, oh, look, there's Iron Man, there's Thor, there's the X-Men, there's Captain America. And, you know, it's marketing. It's super transparent when you're an adult. But as a kid,
right,
you're like, oh, look, that's the comic store. Now I know who the X-Men are. I can get my parents to give me 60 cents to, like, check this out. And, you know, I was reading definitely X-Men, Avengers, Fantastic Four, Spider-Man. And then I was like the DC guy of my friends,
real
Marvel guy. And I'm a Marvel guy, but I was the only guy that also read DC. I was like, no, guys, you should give Teen Titans a chance. It's really cool.
You know, one of the only DC I used to read back in the day was Teen Titans.
It was like their X-Men, you know, like Marv Wolfman and George Perez were like the Chris Claremont and John Byrne of DC.
Yeah, for real. Well, my uncle, he at one point when I was getting into comics, he was like, I have a whole collection of stuff from the 70s and just gave it to me. It was all DC, like World's Finest, you know, Green Lantern, Green Arrow, all that stuff. So I read through all that type of stuff, but I was always more Marvel. Isn't it so weird now that we're in 2021 now, and there's been 23 Marvel Cinematic Universe movies based on these characters that if we talked about as a kid, we'd have been made fun of.
Right.
And they're so, and they're such a staple in pop culture now. It's that one Iron Man movie, because they tried for years and years to make it happen. Spider-Man, you know, of course, the Spider-Man movies did for a while, but not to the level we're at now. But that Iron Man movie, whatever kind of money they can give Jon Favreau for everything, it's not enough.
Right. And he's now saving Star Wars The Mandalorian as well. I mean, I think the cool thing for me was that, especially into my teenage years, one of my earliest jobs was working at a comic store. And that's kind of when this is like 92. So this is when I'd already kind of drifted away from the X-Men because it was so soap operatic.
Yeah.
And it just was getting too convoluted, you know, even for me. And I was it's like, there's too many titles now. It's mindfuck. But so I was an Avengers guy. That was like my book. I was like, I just like big fucking popcorn, 10 superheroes fighting like something that's going to like destroy the whole universe. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't like nobody bought it, but it wasn't the popular shit. You know, Spider-Man and the X-Men was what was popular.
I was a big Avengers fan too. I mean, shit, they did it up. They did an issue with David Letterman. I mean, come on.
Right. I have that one. I think I have a run somehow in one of my last move. I'm now missing like 4 issues in the middle, but I think I have a run from like 120 something to like 330.
Wow.
That's complete except for those 4 consecutive issues from like 199 to 203 or whatever. And I had them. I just have no idea where they went. But yeah, so it's really gratifying as a fan to me to see that this is what's become successful is Iron Man, Captain America, Thor first, and then Spider-Man. It's like, okay, cool. Like, you know, that, cause that's more exciting. Cause it's less, you know, everybody was sick of Spider-Man. Like the movie going audience was like, we don't need another fucking Spider-Man.
Yeah.
But that's why they didn't show him getting bitten by the radioactive spider and all that. They're like, yeah, we know. We fucking know. Like, okay, enough already. And, so yeah, it's just been like a really cool time to be a fucking nerd.
Yeah, Kevin Feige did it the correct way of reintroducing Spider-Man. We don't need to know the fucking origin story again. Right. We know it by now. Introduce him in something else, and then give him his own movie.
Right. Ryan Mueller in the comments just said they still can't make a Fantastic Four movie worth a damn, and now that they have the rights to them, I think that they need to take that approach with the Fantastic Four. I think from this point on, they just need the Fantastic Four just need to exist within the universe. It's like we don't need an origin story.
Right.
They can just be there, and that's okay.
Well, you know, our bass player in Exhumed, Ross, he went to high school right across the street from where I grew up, and he shopped at a comic store where I worked. And so we spent a lot of time like annoying our bandmates in the band talking about various, you know, especially like Bronze Age, 70s and 80s Marvel stuff. And we were talking about the Fantastic Four, and we were talking about how do you make this movie good? How do you do this franchise? And we both said that the Fantastic Four really only makes sense in the 60s, their whole origin story, their whole vibe, everything. Mm-hmm. And if I was a writer at Marvel in the film division, especially because we know Kang is the big bad, which was teased already in, yep, in Endgame. As soon as he said, when you mess with time, time tends to mess back with you or whatever, I was like, oh, they're going to do Kang. Cool. Anyway, so if you do the first Fantastic Four movie and it starts in the 60s and they go into the negative zone, and because now time is being screwed up with Multiverse of Madness or whatever they're going to do with Doctor Strange,
yeah,
then you can bring them to nowadays, and that's where you get the laughs because you have Ben Grimm going, what a revolt in development, you know, like in talking like somebody from the 60s. And that is where you're going to get your jokes and your laughter and your fish out of water stuff.
Okay, they should fucking hire you because that's amazing.
I like that idea.
Yeah. Because that to me, it keeps the spirit of the property, and it also makes it fun. And it's something that we haven't seen before. We've seen the 90s, we've seen the 40s, but what about the 60s, right?
That whole fish out of water type of thing they did with Captain America being frozen for so many years and then waking up. That'd be great. All four of them. I mean,
yeah. And especially with Sue, because in the old Stan Lee Kirby run, like, I swear to God that if you look at the art, the Jack's drawing, it's not so bad. But then if you read the dialogue that Stan puts in over it, it's like, get away, Sue. I wouldn't expect your dumb woman brain to understand what a nihilist can do to us.
Right.
And she's constantly sort of being like, oh, you're just this weak woman that needs to get rescued kind of thing. And really, she's probably the most powerful member of the group.
Maybe that's why she's Invisible Girl, because...
Right. Mm-hmm. And so it would be a really great thing to sort of bring her from the 60s being this sort of like timid housewife, you know, kind of expectation of life into being this incredibly powerful woman. And Reed's always like, well, Sue, darling, blah, blah, blah. And it'd be like,
what?
It makes, he might be really smart, but he's dumb.
That whole multiverse thing, it makes sense for them to use that as an introduction for possibly Fantastic Four. Because, you know, like with the Ant-Man stuff where they're in the negative, what is it, quantum realm. It's sort of negative zone ish, but right, they could, you know, they make up their own rules a little bit. They could sort of like go back into the quantum realm to do something, and they find them somehow and they bring them back.
And why couldn't, you can just be like, oh, instead of they're trying to go to the moon or whatever to beat the commies in 1961, they're trying to go into what Reed Richards calls the negative zone, but it's really the quantum realm. And it's like easy. I mean, it's just, you know, you can write this stuff in a way that
keeps
the spirit of it, but ties into what's already going on.
I mean, they prove that you can go back in there and pull people out because they pulled Wasp out.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, especially if once they start dealing with time travel as a big thing in whatever the Kang storyline is going to be. And if you're doing multiverse stuff, then you can do fun shit like they did on the Crisis on Infinite Earths TV crossover where they had like Burt Ward as Robin.
Yeah.
And his world's getting annihilated. And they had, you know, all the sort of, you can acknowledge these various properties that have been developed through the years in a way that's sort of fun. And I don't know. I think that would be what makes sense to me, is that they come from the 60s, then they arrive here. Annihilus and Blastar are after them because they're also in the negative zone quantum realm. That's the first movie. The second movie is that Victor Von Doom is somehow still alive from the 60s because he has the energy from the quantum realm that's allowed him to defy time or whatever. And now he realizes Reed Richards is back and he's like, oh, this fucking asshole. And then that's your second movie. And then the third movie, of course, is Galactus and the Silver Surfer. You know, you can't just
look. Fucking dork.
Look at right.
and Galactus is not a fucking cloud. I'm sorry.
Yes. No. He's a giant purple man.
Yes. He devours planets.
Right.
Yes.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, with all that multiverse stuff, it's just way for them to rewrite any kind of rules they want. It's like, we can do whatever we want.
Yes. And it's a really slippery slope, though, because then, I mean, it's just ultimately my fear is that they're going to turn off the movie going audience the same way that they turn off the comic book reading audience, you know, which is why, you know, it's why DC had to do Crisis on Infinite Earths in the 80s. They're like, this is too convoluted. It's too crazy. People are just going around from reality to reality willy nilly. We don't, there's three Supermans and fucking two Wonder Women and however many Batman and like, what the fuck? We need to straighten this out somehow. And, you know, 23 movies later, that could be a real, you could be really opening a sort of hornet's nest. But I mean, who knows? Maybe the public's attention span will dry up before that happens and they'll move on to whatever the next pop culture thing is. So
Disney hopes you're wrong.
Yeah, I was about to say, they're banking on you being wrong.
Right. I'm happy as a fucking pig in shit. So I hope I'm wrong too.
So, before we move on to anything else, Dave, I don't know if you've seen it, but have you caught up with WandaVision yet?
I haven't seen the most recent one, the one that came out last Friday. I watched the first two.
That's fine. So. That's plenty enough to be caught up for this conversation. So let's talk about WandaVision. We talked about all this multiverse and all this kind of stuff. I know a lot of people do not. This is a very polarizing show. I know a lot of people don't like it. I'm going to go ahead and say I love the show. I know exactly where they're going with it. It's a great tribute to an homage to the past, you know, sitcoms of the 50s, 60s, and even the 70s and 80s now. I mean, shit, the director and Kevin Feige sat down with Dick Van Dyke to get his information about doing a sitcom based in that time. I mean,
Doing a gruesome of the Dick Van Dyke show.
Exactly. That's what they did. what do you think about it, Matt? Let's go there first, because I know we've talked about it a little bit in the Metal Geek Society, which if you're not in there, check out the Metal Geek Society on Facebook, where we have a lot of geeky discussions like this.
I don't love it. I certainly don't hate it. I felt like the first two episodes, the pacing was really off. I felt like they could have accomplished it in one episode easily. The revelation that something is wrong is like, it's not really a revelation. Obviously there's something wrong because we know that A, Vision's dead, B, that Wanda lives in current day. So we know something is wrong. It's like, wow, there's something not right here. Like, no fucking shit. And I felt like they just spent a little bit too much time showing you how authentic of a sitcom it was. I did like the glamour and illusion callback or Easter egg or whatever you want to call it in episode two, because I love the, like we were talking about today on the chat group, I love the Steve Englehart series. I love Steve Englehart's writing just in general. And so I thought that was a lot of fun, and I thought that the second episode seemed to really get the point across. And I was like, I don't know why the first episode was a thing. The third episode I liked a lot more, and I felt like they're sort of starting to move the bigger story arc along. Yeah. And, you know, I don't want to spoil it for you, Dave. But, you know, it just seemed like, wow, things are actually happening now. And, like, it started to be like, okay, this is actually kind of weird. Whereas the first episode was, like, just an episode of the Dick Van Dyke Show with a glitch. And, mm-hmm.
I mean, it was a recreation of the living room down to the T and everything.
Right.
I definitely agree there. I do. Vision and Scarlet Witch was one of my favorite series, both volumes that they did. And a lot of people are like, oh, is this like the Tom King Vision? Like, this is the only thing that's even, you know, sort of close to it is it's in the suburbs type of deal, you know?
Right.
But, you know,
that was a great series.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal. It's one of my favorite series of all time. If you haven't read the Tom King Vision series, where he like basically creates his own family, and they're still using some of those characters today, like they use Viv.
Oh, cool.
She's part of Champions and all that good stuff. That was a dog, which is weird. But you can't get rid of a good doggy in the Marvel universe, apparently.
I mean, Nobody wants to see a dog die.
It's no. But I grew up on the Nick at Night stuff, so I can definitely, I appreciate it. But, and there was, I can see the pacing. People say the pacing was a little slow, but there are a lot of people that just like, I did not like it. I think they're expecting in-game kind of action, and we're not, right. We're not there yet. We might get there, but you got to remember, this is a 6-episode show. There's only 3 more left basically until the end of it. And it's really going to tie into what's happening in the new Doctor Strange and the multiverse movie, right, and the new Spider-Man movie. So there's something big that's going to happen.
I mean, I feel like, you know, I think it's going to be rewarding in the end. And like I said, I'm a big Vision and Scarlet Witch fan. So even if it totally sucked, I would probably watch it. Although I couldn't get through the Inhumans series, so maybe not.
I never did. Actually, I never started it.
That is a real piece of shit. But, you know, I'm hopeful for it, and I'm curious. And the other thing is, Sword is something that came into the continuity later, like when I wasn't reading a lot of comics. So I'm not even super familiar with Sword or what their
mission is. That's where Nick Fury went off to. It's like S.H.I.E.L.D. Right. for space aliens, basically.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's about as, that's, I knew that, but that's about the,
that's about all I know too.
That's all I know too. So
right, the green haired lady. And yeah, I got that at the end of Spider-Man. I was like, okay, so Captain Marvel 2 is going to be about Sword apparently. I don't know. I think, it's interesting. And I like the fact that they're at least taking some chances instead of being like, hey, look, we're going to drop a building on somebody or whatever. I admire that. I don't know if it's been totally successful yet, but we'll find out, you know.
My wife just said something in the chat. She said, Sword is Marvel's Space Force. It's pretty true. I'm interested to see where this is gonna go. I mean, episode, not to run anything for you, Dave, but episode 3 definitely gets better. They're actually starting to, things break down a little bit more between reality. And that's my question. Mm-hmm. Where do you,
I can tell what's going there.
Oh yeah. People think that this is inside. She's created this pocket reality because she couldn't deal with the loss of killing Vision. She couldn't deal with that. Mm-hmm. So she created this reality that's breaking something in the real world, I believe. And that's trying to get her out to stop that from happening. I don't know. No, that's my opinion.
I don't know about the source material as much as you guys do. Like, I don't know. I don't know where they're going with this. I don't know what the story is, but, to me, a lot of the pacing weirdness was not like an overall thing. I felt like there were moments that were really strangely paced. Like it was just like this, like 5 seconds was really weirdly staged and timed. And I didn't know if it was on purpose or I couldn't tell, like, is this an artistic choice?
I think because they really artistically, they went back, they used old lenses and old lighting. It's at one point,
and all that stuff is cool. Cause I have kind of a thing for all sorts of retro media. I love all kinds of old retro media stuff, old advertisements and, you know, old TV shows and everything. Like, we still watch The Twilight Zone regularly at my house. It's one of the all-time great TV shows, you know? And so I have an appreciation for the styles that they're aping. And so it's fun to watch just from that standpoint, just to see how they do that. But I can tell it's going somewhere interesting, but I have no idea what it is yet. So,
right.
I don't think anybody does yet.
There were a lot of moments where, like you were saying, Dave, where I was just like, huh? And yeah. I'm not ready to drink the Kool-Aid and be like, oh, they're just amazing. Like, this is all on purpose and it's so artistic, but maybe it is.
Maybe not.
Weird. I actually watched each episode twice just to be like, did I miss something here? Like, huh?
Okay, no, that was it. After I watched the first two, I made a comment to my wife. I was like, do you think this would have worked better? And this is a question for both of you guys. Do you think this whole series would have worked better if they dropped it all at one time? You can binge watch it instead of like waiting week to week.
You know what? I hadn't thought about that, but maybe so. like I get why they're doing the Mandalorian episode by episode.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's episodic enough and that it makes you long for, what's going to happen next time? Where's this going? You know, but this one is weird enough that I think maybe you're right, that maybe they should have just done. And especially, you said it's going to be 6 episodes?
I think so, yeah.
At that point, just drop it all at once.
Yeah.
I think it would be much more rewarding to get it all at once because, The Mandalorian it's like a serial. There's an overarching plot.
Mm-hmm. Each episode stands alone as well.
Right. Yep. You could just watch one in the middle and be like, okay, cool. Whereas this is not like that really at all, at least so far. And I think that, and plus I just, I would have watched the whole thing in like the first day.
I would have too.
I mean, I remember like even when the Defenders came out, which wasn't even really a good series. I watched all 8 episodes in like a weekend. I was like, cool. All right. This is what I'm doing this weekend. So for me, it's sort of frustrating. I'm like, I've been paying for the subscription to Disney Plus, which I only got for the Marvel shows because I didn't know about the Mandalorian at the time. And I was like, I've been waiting like a year now. I've been paying $8 a month. Like, just give me what I fucking want. But yeah, it doesn't seem episodic like that. It's not, it doesn't have that tidy pacing.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, like I said, I'm hopeful that it's going to do well. I mean, I think they haven't really, there's been definitely movies that I liked less than others, but I think everything they've done has been at least pretty good. So I think, this is going to be at least pretty good and hopefully better,
We got Monica Rambeau, so hopefully we get her version of Captain Marvel soon. That'd be right. Awesome.
Yeah, that was the one that I grew up with.
Yeah.
I think Marvel was already dead. They did the graphic novel or whatever when that was a new format. that had already happened before I knew really about the character. So to me, Captain Marvel was this black chick from Louisiana who used to be in the Coast Guard and turned into light and flew around, and she was awesome. So I was really stoked, even in the Captain Marvel movie, that she was there as a kid. And I was like, yes, that means she's going to be there later. So.
Yeah, I was a big West Coast Avengers fan growing up. I don't know why. There's something about that series just got
Steve
me.
Englehart.
Yeah.
And I actually recently, I have the Marvel Unlimited app, so I have a kind of mind-numbing job where I just do repetitive tasks all day. So I just sit there and read comics all day, and I recently just reread the Steve Englehart and the John Byrne run of West Coast Avengers. And I reread the Scarlet Witch and Vision series, the individually and together, just because I knew the show was coming out. And
I have those West Coast Avengers and trades. Still love them.
Yeah. It's weird because I never liked the art. Like, Al Milgram didn't really do anything for me. But especially the time travel story where they are sent back through the Old West, and then they go back to Egypt. And
I remember that.
Mockingbird gets stranded in the Old West and gets raped by the Phantom Rider and all that stuff. Like, I loved that story arc, and I recently reread it, and I was like, this is still, like, really fucking good comics. And Englehart is sort of a master of pulling weird things out of continuity and pulling from his own weird stories. Like, why the fuck are we on, like, why are we, like, in the middle of the earth in a realm of magical cat people? Like, what the fuck is happening? What does this have to do with Iron Man?
Right. I love the Marvel Unlimited Act. They're not sponsors, so we're not going there, but it's some of the best $70 you can spend a year. Cause it's really, they're only what now, they used to be like 6 months behind on their new stuff. Now it's feels like only a few months now, like maybe 3 or 4.
I think it is 3. They recently changed it. Yeah.
So there's so much to read on there. If you've ever been interested about Marvel comics, like, I want to read like Spider-Man from the 60s and 70s and 80s, and it's all there for you.
Yeah. That's actually what I did last summer. I started Amazing Spider-Man 1, and I think I read up to about 280 or so. Because then I was like, well, now I have to be reading Web of Spider-Man and Peter Parker, the Spectacular Spider-Man. And then to flip back and forth on my phone and find which issue came out of which month is too much of a hassle, so I stopped. And so now I've been reading Iron Man from the beginning. I started with whatever Tales of Suspense 55. I think I'm on like issue like 80 or something now. So Yeah, I think I'm going to just read through all that. Then I'm going to just start on the Hulk after that. And just
that was one thing. That was some. That was one character I wasn't really into growing up. I never bought any Hulk issues, so that might be interesting to read some.
I loved the Hulk, but I never really bought a lot of Hulk comics. Like, I loved the TV show.
I loved him when he was in other series, but...
Right. And I loved the cartoon that was alongside Spider-Man's Amazing Friends. One of my... One of my most sobering early childhood memories is I loved the Hulk TV show. And so my mom cut me up some jeans so I could pretend to be the Hulk. And I remember running around. I used to run around my backyard playing Hulk, and I'd be like yelling and flexing my muscles and throwing stuff and all this shit. And, you know, I had this really active imagination, obviously. And I remember like imagining I was the Hulk, like, yeah, then I got thirsty and I thought I would run inside and get a glass of water, but I didn't see that the sliding glass door was closed. My mom was a very tidy woman. She still is. And so I'm like pretending to be the Hulk, and I run into the sliding glass door, boom, it falls smack on my ass.
Oh my God. Like,
you know, one moment I felt like I was super powerful and I could throw a truck, and then the next moment I was like, oh no, I'm just a 5-year-old, like, on the ground. That hurt a lot.
Got a couple of quick comments. Brian says Peter David era Hulk was the best. Peter David stuff is great. He's a nice guy. I got to meet him at Comic Palooza one year. Really cool. And
that was the era that I read the most of. Yeah.
Christian said Marvel Limited is hands down the best deal in entertainment. Agreed. Was thinking of trying DC Infinite. Anyone have it and know what the comic selection is like?
I had the old version of the app, which I got because I was like, they're going to do a Doom Patrol TV show. I need this. I found the selection of comics to be really limited, and the comic reader did not work as well on my phone as the Marvel one. I know that I unsubscribed because they stopped making the TV shows, and that was the main reason that I got it. And I was like, well, I'll get HBO Max at some point, which I haven't done because everyone said the Wonder Woman movie sucked, so I didn't get it.
Horrible. It was not good.
But apparently they've revamped the whole app now, and there's way more comics.
Okay.
And but I don't know, because I was not impressed with the comic experience of the old one. It was cool. Like, the movies and stuff were awesome. You know, like, and it had all the old Super Friends cartoons and stuff, which I think they still have a lot of that stuff. But yeah, I just wanted to watch the Doom Patrol series and the Teen Titans series.
That Doom Patrol series was so good.
It was good.
The second season, you know, when they moved to HBO Max, I didn't enjoy it as much as the first, but it's still really good. It wasn't as weird and quirky.
Did you watch the Titans show?
I did not. I never did.
The first season was like, this could be quite good. And then it was like,
felt too CW drama-ish for me.
It just seemed like they really didn't have a budget, because they get to the climactic thing, either the end of season one or the beginning of season two, where they're going to fight Trigon. They're like, okay, Raven's got Trigon inside her and all the stuff that we know from Teen Titans. Like, okay, cool. This is going to be the big scene. And then Trigon comes out and he looks really stupid. The CGI was terrible. And then the big fight was each of them going in their own memories. And like, I was like, oh God, did you just not have the budget to like make some buildings get smashed and shit?
Do we have to go back to the island here?
Yeah, it was such a letdown.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah. There was good things about the show, but it wasn't like a good show.
Brian again says, as usual, something else that Marvel is better at than DC. Comics, yes. Movies, yes. Animated movies, no. Nope. DC is much, much better.
Dude, I mean, I hardly ever rewatch TV shows, but like I've rewatched the whole Justice League and Justice League Unlimited cartoons, because it's probably the best superhero. Well, that or Young Justice is like the best cartoons.
Have you seen, for a character that I do not like at all, Harley Quinn, have you seen the TV series yet?
Dude, yes, and it's fucking amazing. And I can't stand the character. I was like, she sucks.
Yeah.
But I was like, I guess I'm a fan because this show is incredible.
Yeah, Kaylee Cuoco, that's who played her. Her performance and then the writing on that show is so funny. I didn't know
that that's who was playing her.
Yeah.
I haven't watched any of it, but I've heard you speak highly of it.
It is super worth your time.
Yes.
It's cool because I like Batman the Animated Series and she was a good character there. It's just, the problem is once a villain becomes too popular, you have to turn them into a hero. Mm-hmm. I didn't really care for Venom as a villain and I cannot stand him as an anti-hero. It's fucking dumb. But
secret agent, super agent or whatever he is.
I don't even know what they've done with him, but that's what they've basically done with Harley Quinn now, is that she's too popular to remain a villain.
Yeah.
And the cartoon riffs on that in a way that's really clever and fun. And, it's more like she's not as bad as the worst villains. And she kind of just ends up doing good in spite of herself kind of thing.
It's sort of based in the Batman, the Animated Series universe and definitely the style, but it's definitely it's Venture Brothers writing, it's very, very smart, very quirky. It's just so much fun, dude. You need to watch it.
And Bane is another character that I don't like, but I love what they do with Bane and the Harley Quinn thing. And they just, he's just played for laughs and he has a funny Tom Hardy voice. And it's so good.
And I fucking love Ron Funches as King Shark.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh my God.
I don't know the names of the actors, but King Shark's character was great.
And they're really good, dude. Right. I want to go watch it again. No, it's pretty good.
It's killer, man. I was really shocked at how much I liked it. I was like, well, it's new on the app. I don't have anything else to watch,
I was very apprehensive when I went into the first episode. I'm like, I'm going to check it out. But after that first episode, man, I was just hooked. I'm like, I just binged it for a week. It's great.
Yeah, every Friday or whatever it was when a new episode came out, I was like, yes.
But you started watching this new animated series. Have you seen Big Mouse on Netflix yet? Mm-hmm. That's pretty funny, too. It's
Big Mouth?
Big Mouth. Yeah, M-O-U-T-H.
Okay.
It's self-referential because there was a joke in episode 4 that they're like, oh, hey, that was a joke in episode 3. You're binge watching this right on Netflix right now, aren't you? I was like, okay, that's fucking funny.
Right. The old fourth wall breakage. Yes. Meta,
All right. Dave, do you have any questions?
Do I have any questions?
Yes. About life in general or?
What's it all about, man?
I don't know.
Titties and beer, dude.
Okay. Well, thanks for letting me know.
For me, it's bourbon, but yes.
To each their own.
What's your favorite beer, Matt?
My favorite beer? My favorite beer, I actually don't know the name of. It's a local beer in Munich, and we always play this
venue. Oh, nice.
We always play this venue called Firework in Munich. And in Germany, the way the laws are structured, it's a protectionist thing. So there's no nationalized beers. It's all very regional. So if you go to whatever town, they're going to have their beer, their two or three beers. And the one they have in Munich, I know exactly what the bottle looks like. It's a Helles. It's very much a yellow, fizzy, summertime beer, but it's the perfect balance of refreshing, crisp, has taste, has body, but it's not heavy, and it's like Coors Banquet if Coors Banquet was amazing.
Nice. That's kind of, I actually think that's kind of neat that you have a favorite beer somewhere in the world that you don't know the name of, but you know how to get it when you're there. I kind of
I know what it looks like. You know what I mean? I could pick it out of a lineup, no problem. But yeah, we just always play the same venue and they always have it. And I'm like,
nice.
Even if the show is it wasn't that great. It's usually pretty good in Munich, but even if the show is I was like, well, at least we got a fridge full of this beer and it's killer. So
excellent.
All right, so let's take a few minutes. Let's open up the chat for questions. Great explanation, Dave, says Brian. All right, so questions, anyone? This is where it all came to a screeching halt.
Right.
So let's talk about while we're waiting on that, go back to your bands just a little bit. What do you have planned for 2021? What's in the agenda?
Well, Exhumed and Gruesome will be recording new albums. We're basically demoing Exhumed songs now slowly. My wife and I just bought a condo in December, so I haven't had as much time to sit around demoing tunes as I would like. It's been a process. And then Gruesome, we have a bunch of stuff, but not a lot of songs. So that's going to be coming together in the next couple months, really. And we have tour dates that will probably get canceled for the end of summer and early fall. And then we more realistically might do some dates in the States in October, November.
A full tour or just a couple of one-off shows maybe?
I think it's probably going to be a shorter tour, a 2 or 3 week thing. Just because A, we don't know if it can happen. So making your agent book 6 weeks of shows to cancel them all sucks. And B, we just don't know what the landscape's going to be because so many venues are going to be closed and, promoters will have moved on to doing something else and may not want to go back to promoting shows or, it's going to be a real weird experience going back out there,
So you've played with a lot of different bands during your career. What's the ultimate... I didn't mean it like that, but what was your what's your ultimate dream lineup of a tour?
I mean, I guess to be on the tour, to go out and I'm playing on it, or just to go to the show and see it.
Well, we can do both. I mean, if you want,
I think I'm pretty fortunate at this point. I think I've seen almost all of my favorite bands and I've toured with a bunch of them, we toured with Napalm, we toured with Carcass. I'd really like to go on tour, I think, with Creator because, they've been a favorite of mine forever. And I also think it would be cool because Exhumed obviously is more extreme than Creator, but I think that we could maybe, hook some people that may not be familiar with us or really, would have given us a chance otherwise. And I would just like to see Creator, 30 times in a row.
I can definitely see some crossover appeal between those two crowds.
I just saw them live for the first time maybe 3 years ago, 2 years ago.
Nice.
Phenomenal.
Yeah. And I think for Gruesome, it would be really cool to go out with somebody Possessed or Dark Angel, because those were bands that Chuck was into, and I think would fit really well. I think the main thing for Pounder, really, beyond the dream tour of supporting Maiden or whatever, I think the main thing for us would be just to go out with some like-minded bands that we would fit in well with. That's the thing that we're really hoping for, in the future, is to package with Eternal Champion or Savage Master or, some of those kinds of bands. I
think there's a great, unfortunately got canceled in 2020, of course, but there's a show here called Hell's Heroes.
That's true. The lineup is always great.
Yeah, it'd be great to see you on a show
I'm never able to go, but the lineup of those shows are killer.
Why aren't you able to go?
Because I'm usually... I'm an artist and I vend at events, and that event is usually going on during, I have an 8 week engagement, and it's always on weekends, And so, I'm usually busy vending when Hell's Heroes is going on. So
what a bummer.
Yeah.
This past year was going to be great, but hopefully some of the bands can come back when we get live shows again. Hopefully that's soon, man. I really hope so.
I think fall is going to be fairly realistic, although I haven't really heard the whole vaccine rollout plan yet. I mean, I guess Biden's only been in office for a week, so I shouldn't be too antsy, but I'm come on, this is the main thing here, dude.
Right.
On a waiting list yesterday.
I got on one today, actually.
Oh, good.
I did.
Nice. So, I mean, because that's really going to be the key towards, bringing all this stuff back. It's just going to be getting enough people vaccinated, not just the performers, but obviously the audience as well. So, I just don't realistically see because obviously if you work in healthcare or if you're elderly, you know, you should be getting it first. If you're a frontline worker, if you work for UPS or work at a grocery store or something, like,
they would want next.
And then somewhere down the line, like middle-aged death metal guys, you know, hopefully we'll get it soon. We can go out and play more death metal for people. So
We have a comment here that this is very cool. Casey, the story he did, the vessel for the Horrorama novella was great. Everyone should check it out. Agreed.
Oh, thanks, Casey.
Let's talk about, we didn't bring that up at all, but you have started writing now. How'd that come about?
You know, I've always sort of been like half-assed interested in writing. It's just kind of, a lot of work, which is why I never really pursued it that much. But I actually started writing more seriously a few years ago because I was on tour, and a lot of the time, if you're driving overnight in a van, you tend to you don't get a lot of deep sleep because the van is moving and vibrating. Usually, you know, I've had several drinks the night before, so it's not a situation where you're like soundly off, you know, and out for hours. And because when I'm not in a really deep sleep, I tend to have a lot of REM sleep, and I had this really super dorky dream that Spider-Man and Light Ray for the New Gods were fighting Sauron, the pterodactyl man from the X-Men.
Oh yeah, Sauron.
And I thought, and I was like, why, what? This is the most random combination of stupid characters. And I thought to myself, why would this be a thing? And then I sort of came up with this concept for a whole Marvel DC crossover thing. And I was like, oh, that's, that would be fun. And so I just sat around in the van, just like typing up this like fake script that I could never use for anything because it's full of major corporations, two different major corporations, intellectual property. But it was, it kind of got me just in the habit of writing more. And then I met now a very good friend of mine named Rachel Deering, who's a big Zoom fan, and she's a horror writer, and she also worked in comics, and she does a lot of lettering for like Archie and Dark Horse and stuff, as well as like graphic design shit. And anyway, so having a friend that is like a professional writer is a huge boost, because then you can be like, hey, I was writing this thing. Is it good? And if not, why not? And so anyway, so she started kind of like just giving me some general pointers that made a lot of sense, not just about comic writing, but about writing in general. And I ended up officiating her marriage. And because she's a writer, obviously there's other writers and publishers at her wedding and stuff. And she introduced me to Carrie from Grindhouse Press. And she's like, oh, Harv's a writer. Like, you should publish one of his stories. And I was like, I'm not really a writer. And she's like, yeah, cool. Send me something. I have this like thing. It's like a B-movie horror marathon thing. So come up with something. And, you know, she gave me a really long deadline. And so I wrote this sort of cosmic horror detective story. And apparently it wasn't that shitty because they published it. And that's one of the big things I've been really trying to get back to is writing. But just between trying to demo all these new songs and moving, and then we did the whole show in October, the exhumed show that we filmed. And then I had to help my mom move from South Carolina to Arizona. And it's just, I haven't had any time to like sit down and write much, but I do have some things that I'm trying to sort of start working on, you know.
And I have read your Marvel versus DC script that you sent to me years ago.
It's really rough, a lot of it. I think the plot, I think, is good. And I think, you know, every once in a while, when especially on tour, I'll go back and start editing it down. I'll be like, oh, look, this can just turn into one page. I can get rid of this, rewrite this dialogue kind of thing. But you know, it was something I was interested in enough to like keep me writing, you know?
Awesome, man. Well, I want to thank you for your time, dude. This has been a lot of fun. Are there any other geeky topics you want to talk about before we go? What's on your mind, man?
it's not really a topic, but I guess I'll just show you guys something real quick. Cause I'm looking right at it. It's right behind my monitor here. I'll show you guys I call it my virginity protector back here.
Oh wow!
The Slurpee cups.
Are those the those 70s cups up there?
Yep.
The Marvel.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
And
Secret Wars, man.
All the toys when I was a kid, and a few I've gotten later: Secret Wars, Superpowers, Captain America board game, and I mean, I have a lot more other junk, but I just that's sort of like my favorite stuff. So I keep it here in the studio because, you know, I'm like a married man. My wife is like, no, which I think is probably.
Well, you've never been to my house and it's all over the place.
That's cool. You know, yeah, but it's definitely, yeah, it's definitely something that brings me a lot of joy just looking at it every day when I come in here to work, you know.
Very cool, man. Well, thank you so much for your time, dude. We're going to talk about we'll do some quick housekeeping. First of all, where can people find more information about you?
I have a website called MattHarveyMustBeDestroyed.com where I sort of have a blog and just general news on whatever it is that I'm doing or attempting to do. And then, of course, Exhumed, Gruesome, and Pounder are all on Facebook and Instagram. Exhumed is also on Twitter, and you know, all that good stuff. And we're, you know, pretty active and as far as, you know, keeping up new content and shit. So, you know, if you're interested, please follow us there. It's the easiest way. We have a web store at exhumed.bigcartel.com where we have merch from all my bands, mostly Exhumed stuff, but also other stuff. And yeah.
Awesome. Check all that stuff out. Dave, we'll go to you real quick.
You can find me and my artwork. You can find my social media is at Red Viking Dave. You can buy my art at redvikingdave.etsy.com. I just renewed a thought in my head today that I think I'm going to start pursuing soon. I think I'm going to start working on battle vest patches with my artwork on. Ages back, and I think I'm ready to start working on that.
I just had to remove my Iced Earth one, so I have spot.
Yeah. Right. Yep.
We both did that. Yeah. If you haven't seen his, if yet, not to blow up smoke up your butt, Dave, but if you haven't seen his work, Matt, he's a phenomenal artist. Crazy.
I'm heading there now. So it's redvikingdave.etsy.com.
Yep.
Okay, cool. All right. I'm bringing it up now. I'll check it out when we get off the line here.
Cool. And so for us, we're at Metal Geeks on all the social medias. Email msrcast@gmail.com if you want to give us any feedback, if you have a topic or any kind of ideas. If you have a George Hates a Metal idea, we want to hear it. We want them to suffer through. Of course, metalgeeks.net. We're on the web there. We're also on all kinds of places where you can download a podcast. We're on Spotify and Stitcher and Apple Music and all those other ones. Of course, you can also find us at esonetwork.com. That's a place where you can go to find all the cool shows that make up the network, all the geeky stuff. And we're also on the one RSS feed there and all your social media places as well. That's it, man. I appreciate you coming on and geeking out. Anytime you want to come back, dude, you're welcome.
Awesome. It was always a pleasure, man.
Thanks for everybody for hanging out in the room tonight. And as always, our last thing we always have to say is, keep it metal keep it geeky.
I'm on it. I'm already there.
All right, man. Thanks so much.
All right. Cheers, guys. Thanks.
Thanks to listening to another fine podcast brought to you by MSR Productions. All rights reserved, blah, 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 blah. For reviews, archives of our podcasts, and all your other metal geekery needs, please visit metalgeeks.net.
Here at the Cosmic Pizza Podcast, we make every show from the finest ingredients.
Juicy interviews, fiery film nights, delicious desert island DVDs.
And pack it all into a slice of life in every episode.
Order up our specials now from your delivery guys.
Shine from Canada.
Dan from Kent in the UK.
And Paul from near Liverpool in the UK.
Here on the ESO Network.
The Cosmic Pizza Podcast.
Serving you a slice of life.
Mm-mm.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.